call 05AP1978-D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Gary R. George. Arguing on behalf of Mr. George will be two lawyers, Mr. Cahill, who will get 15 minutes, Mr. Hazelbaker, who will get 10 minutes. Then Mr. Basting will argue on behalf of the Office of Lawyer Regulation for 30 and 5 minutes in rebuttal for you, Mr. Cahill. Right? You may proceed, counsel.
Justice. May it please the court, my name is Richard Cahill. I appear here with my co-counsel, Mark Hazelbaker, on behalf of Gary George, the appellant respondent in this lawyer disciplinary case. We are appealing from the report and recommendation of Supreme Court referee Gene Radcliffe, and in particular that portion of the referee's report which calls for a revocation of Senator George's license to practice law. We're asking that the court reject that recommendation and instead impose a suspension. In making that request, I'd like to make 3 points. Number one, without meaning to deprecate in any way the seriousness of the offense of which Mr. George was convicted or to disavow that offense, the gravamen of the federal crime for which he was convicted was a misuse of his office staff and a failure to report on his Chapter 19 financial disclosure filings, otherwise lawful conduct that he was engaged in. Secondly, that...
What happened to the kickback allegations? Wasn't that part of it?
Calling it a kickback doesn't make it a kickback.
Okay, the allegations involving the $273,000.
Yes.
That's
yes. And if I may, that had to do with Mr. George's relationship with attorney Mark Sostrich, with whom he was sharing fees for work rendered to OIC, a federally funded agency doing W-2 work. Nothing unlawful about lawyers sharing fees. The rules contemplate the sharing of fees by lawyers. The rules contemplate the sharing of fees out of proportion to services rendered. And that was done in this case. It was done with the knowledge of OIC. There was never an allegation that OIC didn't know and approve of the work, that the work wasn't capably rendered, that both of these lawyers didn't contribute to it. And the only thing that made it inappropriate, in our view, is the failure to have made a report of the receipt of that money on the state financial disclosure statements.
Counsel, a federal offense.
It is not a federal offense.
What was the federal offense?
Well, the federal offense was cobbled together on appeal by Judge Easterbrook, who bailed out the U.S. attorney, in my opinion, by saying we have to have a federal victim, and the federal victim is the recipient of the federal funds, the OIC. And the reasoning that Judge Easterbrook applied, and it's quoted, in fact, in the OLR's brief, is this. Mr. Sostrich and Mr. George were paid a monthly retainer, 20% of which went to Mr. Sostrich, who did most of the work, and 80% went to Mr. George. Because Mr. Sostrich was willing to do the work for 20% of the retainer, that's all the work was worth. And the balance represented a loss to OIC. Well, that is just preposterous logic.
Well, what kind of federal problem is that?
Well, that it's defrauding OIC of its right to honest services because they are somehow getting less than they bargained for. But there was never an allegation that that work wasn't fully done, capably done, well done, and the U.S. attorney and the Justice Department didn't make any effort to show that OIC was really cheated, except to say that this was done without the knowledge of the public and therefore was inappropriate.
Well, somewhere in the back of all this, you get the sense that maybe these were payments to get particular benefits and services as a result of being a state senator.
Yes, exactly. And that's the innuendo, and that is an allegation that was never made and a proposition upon which proof was never offered. There isn't a shred of evidence in either the federal record or in this record that Mr. George ever lent any support, particularly to OIC, against which he voted. He voted against W-2, and neither OIC nor Mr. Bowles was the recipient of any influence exercised by Mr. George. There was never an allegation that one of his votes was corruptly made.
Would that be a federal offense?
Well, it would be a federal and a state offense, I think, because that would have been the purchase of his influence inappropriately by this agency. The fact is that Mr. George was a business getter. And he was a business getter, I think, in part by virtue of the stature conferred upon him by his office. But there is simply nothing wrong with politicians achieving stature that benefits them in some way, so long as it's not corruptly wielded.
Mr. Kao, can you remind us of what charge Mr. Sostrich pled guilty to?
He's pled guilty to a very similar charge, and I believe it was a violation of U.S. Code Section 371, that particular subsection that said that he was guilty of depriving his clients of the intangible right to honest services, something which the Justice Department, particularly under Alberto Gonzalez, used very broadly in a multitude of cases, it well beyond, I think, its intended purpose. The original law was drafted to keep insiders on behalf of corporations from taking bribes from vendors to the corporation. But it broadly construed, it was used by the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District in both the Sostrich case, the Hausman case, and in this case as well.
And what was the ultimate result as far as OLR was concerned with Mr. Sostrich?
Mr. Sostrich was prosecuted. There was a trial. A one-year suspension was recommended by a referee. This court ultimately imposed an 18-month suspension on Mr. Sostrich.
Did we make it retroactive at all?
Yes. As you have in all your cases, you've made it retroactive to the date of the temporary suspension.
Now, George was temporarily suspended right?
Yes.
What is the date of that temporary
suspension? That was March 20th, 2004. He was summarily suspended. And I believe he didn't resist the motion of the OLR to do so. But the court has done that in the Koala case, in the Burke case, in the Sostrich case, pretty consistently made suspensions retroactive to the date of the temporary suspension.
Does it have to? Does the court have to make it retroactive?
I don't believe you do. But I believe consistency with what you've done in the past would suggest the appropriateness of doing that. If, in fact, as I would suggest, this case is much like the Koala case, the Burke case, the Henningsen case, the Hunsick case, it calls for a suspension of perhaps a couple years. That's the most that was imposed in any of those cases I've just alluded to, all of which are, in my opinion, involving conduct much more culpable and reflecting adversely on fitness to a much higher degree than that of which Mr. George was guilty.
In those cases, and I don't remember, I know we have here two figures, $273,000 with regard to the OIC, and then I think there's $296,000 with regard to the employees.
Yes.
How does that compare with those other cases that you were just reciting?
Those numbers are high. Those numbers that you've just recited in Mr. George's case are high.
When you say they're high, am I miscitating them or am I correct?
No, I think you're roughly correct. I think the aggregate amount of restitution ordered was about $568,000. But as I've just said, part of that analysis is this faulty proposition that what Mr. Sostrich was willing to accept for the work is all the work was worth. I mean, that pretty much deprecates pro bono services, for one thing, and it suggests that in the event lawyers share fee on a referral basis in a contingency case, and the trial lawyer is willing to do the work for two-thirds of the one-third fee, that the client is then cheated by the amount paid to the referring lawyer. It suggests that at Foley and Lardner, when they send a young associate to do work on behalf of a corporation, bill them out at $250 an hour, and then pay them an annual salary, which is the equivalent of perhaps $100 per hour, that the client is being cheated of the difference. It is just really intellectually hypocritical, in my opinion, to use that formulation. And with respect to the state employees, there was a pretty loose analysis of saying, well, certain of these employees were engaged in political activities, they weren't separately reimbursed, and so we're going to ascribe, I think, in a number of cases, half their salary for this period of time as the extent to which the state was cheated, and we're going to order restitution in that amount. The restitution order in this case, in my opinion, is very overstated.
What's your opinion as to why 4 years were imposed? That's pretty strong, and yet as you argue it, it sounds like it's little more than a violation of completing your ethics statement. So there's a misconnect there. You've got to help me.
Yes, it is. And in my opinion, the undertaking of the prosecution in the first instance and the sentence that was ultimately imposed represented a miscarriage of justice. I just do not think that the conduct as it actually transpired in this case warranted what befell Mr. George, either in the federal system or here. Certainly, this is not a revocation case. He didn't do anything more than lawyers do all the time. He just simply did not, for whatever reason, and I'm sure he regrets it. There's reference in the transcript to his misplaced reliance on the DeBartolaban case in not making known on his ethics filings that he was receiving these monies, and he didn't report it. I'm sure he would tell you if he were here, I regret that. I wish I had done that. And it wasn't mindful, perhaps, of this court's modification of the Supreme Court rules on confidentiality under 1.6, adding the subsection D that said nothing in the confidentiality rules prohibits a state official from reporting the identity of clients on reporting statements.
So your argument that to explain this abyss between 4 years in prison and over $500,000 in restitution and the essential argument that you're making is that this was really primarily a violation of the financial disclosure statement. That's such an abyss. You got to fill it in.
Well, I think that there probably was. The authorities may have harbored some view that OIC wasn't receiving full value for the services they were being charged for. But there was never an effort to prove that was so. Attorney Sosterich said that he faithfully rendered his bills to the OIC, and there was no criticism by OIC. They knew about the work. The work was well done. The work was capably done, and the work was fairly billed. I think that it was an effort on the part of the federal authorities to try to exalt the offense beyond its appropriate parameters.
Mr. Kao, you said there was no disclosure on the state financial disclosure form.
Yes.
What about on the state and federal income tax returns?
I believe it was reported there. I don't know. He was not charged with a tax crime of which I'm aware. And I do know that in connection with the Chapter 19 filing, he did list Mark Sosterich as a party from whom he received money. So he was not trying to hide that the receipt of that money. But much like other lawyer legislatures who might say, for example, I've received funds from Holling and Kao Law Firm without identifying the particular clients, he did not identify the clients whose money was coming to him through Mark Sosterich.
Has a restitution been made?
No, it hasn't. And Mr. George is without the means of making it. I believe this, that in the federal case there may still be motions for an adjustment of the restitution order in light of the decision in the Jensen case concerning what might properly be attributable to the misuse of office staff. But restitution has not been paid, and he's without the means of doing so and without prospects of doing so unless the court gives him a chance to redeem himself and to resume his livelihood as a practicing law as a lawyer. The other point I'd like to make, if I may, is that a revocation in this case is totally out of keeping with the ABA sanction guidelines. That one cited by referee Radcliffe in his report. And incidentally, referee Radcliffe's report affords the court very little basis from which to work. This case was tried on April 20th, 2006, and in December of 2006, the court reminded the referee of his obligation to file a report within 30 days. And upon doing so, referee Radcliffe took a brief submitted before the hearing by Mr. Basting, copied it, added a couple little sentences and paragraphs, no analysis, no judgment whatsoever, and signed it and submitted it to you as his report. And notwithstanding the almost boundless respect that I have for Mr. Basting, that wasn't doing the referee's job. He simply just copied Mr. Basting's briefing, even typographical errors that show up in Mr. Basting's sanction memorandum show up in referee Radcliffe's report to you. And in particular, the ABA sanction guideline, which he cites, and from which he sends an excerpt, has to do with revocation being a suitable disposition in cases involving grievous felonies that include theft, murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and the like. It's just not applicable to this case. And we've cited in our brief Section 522 of the ABA sanction guidelines, which says, if I may read it, suspension is generally appropriate when a lawyer in an official or governmental position knowingly fails to follow proper procedures or rules and causes injury or potential injury to a party or to the integrity of the legal process. That's really what happened here, and that's why, in my view, a suspension is warranted. Mr. George knows...
Oh, go ahead.
Mr. George knows that this is a serious matter. It was a felony. It is a felony of the kind that does reflect adversely on fitness, but a substantial penalty by way of professional discipline is any suspension of a year or more. You would not unduly deprecate the seriousness of this offense. You would just bring it into line to what the court did in the Koala case, the Burke case, the Hunsick case, the Henningsen case, and the Sostrich case. I mean, the referee says this is a serious felony as if that's the end of the analysis. And it's just the beginning, because the court will see there's a host of cases where serious felonies are dealt with by this court by means of a suspension.
If a court suspends for 4 years, 11 months, and 28 days versus revoke, other than the couple of days I'm talking about, right, what's the difference, if any?
Well, two things. Number one, I think that the applicant enjoys some presumptive entitlement to reinstatement upon the expiration of the stated period of time, unless there's some other misconduct or wrongful conduct in the meantime. He would still have the burden of proof of showing fitness to be reinstated, but he would also be able to apply then 3 months before the expiration of that suspension by Supreme Court rule, as opposed to in a revocation case waiting the full 5 years.
Thank
so
you.
That would be of some benefit.
Thank you,
Thank
Mr.
You.
Kao. Mr. Hazelbaker.
May it please the Court, I'm Mark Hazelbaker from Hazelbaker & Associates, and I'm proud to represent Gary George today in the matter before the Court. And I'm here to address another dimension of this case, which is the mitigating effect that this Court should give to Gary George's record of public service. If there's any single principle which underlies every single requirement of the rules of professional conduct, it is that a lawyer must, in all dealings, be expected to put the interests of the client, the court, and the community before the lawyer's own selfish interest. I submit to you that there's no better way to see the kind of a character, the kind of a person that Gary George really is, than to look at his history of public service, his long history of putting the interests and welfare of others before his own selfish interest. Doing that, you'll see that this individual has made a major contribution to Wisconsin, a contribution that should be weighed in making this solemn decision before you, because the real difference between the suspension and revocation really comes down to this. Will Gary George realistically have the chance to practice law again, to redeem himself, and to contribute with the skills that he does have in the kind of out of the character that he also has? Gary earned a degree from the University of Michigan Law School, and when he did earn that, he had a lot of choices open to him. Instead of choosing another career path that might have been much more lucrative, he decided to pursue public service, served in the Wisconsin Senate for 23 years. But it wasn't just ordinary public service of the kind that we get from many dedicated public servants. For one thing, Gary represented one of the poorest and least powerful constituencies in the state, people who literally had often no other resources to turn to. His office was a place of assistance where people could get help, and he used it to help an underprivileged constituency, not the kind of people that showed up to fundraisers, not the kind of people that would help him get reelected, the kind of people that had nobody else to stand up for him, and he did that. I could go on for hours about his achievements. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to try to list them in summary fashion, however unfair that is to Gary George. He was the co-chair of the Finance Committee from the moment that, or on the Finance Committee, and served as co-chair for all of the 1980s and early 90s. That's how I met Gary. I was a lobbyist for the Wisconsin Counties Association at that time. I worked with him closely and found him to be someone who is genuinely interested in helping underprivileged people, people who needed a hand, which is something that the county's association worked with a lot. Gary was on the chairman of the Joint Audit Committee, served on the Public Broadcasting Council, headed a number of legislative council committees on issues like sexual assault, child abuse, foster care, adoption. He was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee and was a key player in a number of important legal reform efforts like sentencing, truth in sentencing. He worked on a family law, the family law issues about the rights of fathers. Unlike a lot of people that are routinely condemned for being part of a revolving door between government and business, he didn't go on to practice divorce law, even though he had made a big contribution to the rights of fathers. He did it because it was the right thing to do. There's a small example, a couple of small examples that I think really say a lot about this point I'm making that Gary gave of his time and thereby sacrificed a great deal of what could have been significantly greater income to himself for other people. He was the chairman of the Milwaukee County Zoo Board for several years, and he spent hours every month at board meetings working on zoo business. Why did he do that? Because in his district, the zoo had, for the free days at the Milwaukee County Zoo, was one of the few things open to poor kids as a way to get out there and have a good time with their families. And he stayed on that board for years as budget cut after budget cut after budget cut came down to make sure that that access stayed there. He became active in Wisconsin Special Olympics in 1978. He helped hundreds of disabled youngsters and other people come out of the shadows and have a chance to achieve something and to show that they amounted to something. So this man is not somebody that's in it solely for Gary George. And I believe that if the court gives him the chance to return to the practice of law by giving him a suspension instead of a revocation, you will find that he will be able once again to contribute something to society. He also has a record as a legislator that is nothing to be ashamed of. He was the principal architect of the Milwaukee School Choice Program because of his concern for the education of children in Milwaukee. That did not in any way help him politically. It made him a target. He supported minority business enterprise legislation, worked to maintain access to the university, led efforts to curb teenage pregnancy. These were issues that were not necessarily hot-button issues, and in fact, Gary was often on the outs with the political leadership in the Senate. He did it because it was the right thing to do, because he does have a conscience. He made a mistake, and there isn't anybody in this room who hasn't. Is he an irredeemable, corrupt, vile individual who should be broken publicly as an example to other lawyers not to transgress? No. I've known Gary for 25 years. I volunteered to help him in this case because I believe in him, because I've known that he is a decent human being who did an awful lot of good for the people of this state and for the people of his district. He deserves someone to stand with him in this time in his life, and I was proud to do it, and I'm proud to be here today. I would also make the point that Mr. George does have a restitution arrangement. Although it's very slow, he mentioned that to me before we went on the record, he certainly is not going to be able to pay off a $600,000 restitution obligation anytime soon, but he has been diligent in cooperating with that. One final observation, Justice Bradley asked a very good question. How can you square the characterization of the conduct with the severity of the penalty that Senator George received? One simple answer, the federal sentencing guidelines. At the time in which Senator George was sentenced, if you are convicted of a certain statutory offense, as I'm sure you're all aware, then you start looking at where you fit on the grid. And if you fit at a certain place on the grid, other than the possibility of mitigating circumstances, you get a certain sentence. Some of those sentences are very harsh. And I think we've seen even this past week in the Supreme Court's decision on the crack cocaine issue that they're beginning to recognize that, geez, maybe we've taken too much discretion away from trial judges. And I might add, by doing that, given prosecutors too much power. Because when you are a prosecutor, knowing what those guidelines empower you to extract at sentencing, you have an awful lot of bargaining power. You can say to a defendant, look, plead to this, or we're going to supersede you in the federal system. You can keep adding indictment after indictment after indictment if the grand jury will return another one, and that's about as hard as ordering a ham sandwich, as the cliche goes. and you keep on putting more and more steps in the grid before the defendant. Of course people plead out to charges like that. In fact, there is a huge disparity between the federal and the state system in that respect, and if the other state legislators whose conduct has come before this court had been in the federal system, they wouldn't have gotten 13-month sentences or 9-month sentences. They'd have gone to Leavenworth or Yankton in South Dakota, where Gary went, for very long periods of time. I'm not saying that he didn't do wrong. He pled guilty to the crime. I took this case on knowing full well that he did it. But he didn't do anything that was, of a character compared to what Senator Quayle and Senator Burke did. Those gentlemen sold legislation. You talked about hundreds of thousands of dollars. The value of the integrity of our state government is priceless. And people who sold legislation got 2-year suspensions. Mr. George, who is accused of having made a stupid and egregious mistake, already has served more time on suspension than either Senator Burke or Senator Quayle. And if he's revoked, he's going to have to basically prove he's a moral person. And these two gentlemen who have been suspended for selling legislation don't have to go over that hurdle.
Now,
that doesn't
matter. Now, what were their charges? I don't recall that. It might have been. I just don't recall.
Senator Quayle was convicted of using public resources to raise...
I mean, did either of them have a charge and pled guilty to selling legislation? That's not the charge, but what, I know what you mean, and I can't think of it.
Misconduct in office and making illegal... Senator Quayle pled guilty to one count of misconduct in public office and one count of making an excessive campaign contribution, and the 6 other counts for which he was charged were read in. He was charged with originally extortion, misconduct, unlawful contributions, and the like. The record speaks for itself.
And I just want to know what the record is.
Sure.
That is, what were the pleas to,
sure.
And in this case? What were the charges upon
which
there
was Burke was charged with a single charge of intentional misuse of public office. And let me hasten to add, although I'm
Attorney Burke entered a guilty plea to count 1, misconduct in public office in violation of 93905 and 946.12 sub 3. And he also pled guilty to obstructing, Class A misdemeanor. And then I think... Quayle entered into a plea agreement in the resolve that he pled guilty to one count of misconduct in public office, Class E felony, one count of making a campaign contribution exceeding the lawful limit as a party to the crime. And then 8 counts were dismissed.
Were any of those counts selling legislation?
Well, I would say that the count of, no, they weren't explicitly. The count of misconduct in public office was using his public office to raise funds, which is sort of the same thing, only backwards. You know, you're saying, I'm a senator, therefore, and an influential one, give me money. It may not be selling legislation, it may be certainly soliciting money in exchange for legislation. And by the way, I will be heard when Senator Quayle's suspension comes up for review to testify in favor of his reinstatement, because I believe redemption should be part of all punitive processes. And similarly, Gary George deserves a second chance. I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Thomas J. Basting, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation. Mr. Basting.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court. Pleasure to be back here again today. My name is Thomas J. Basting, Sr., and I represent the Office of Lawyer Regulation as retained counsel in this matter. You are going to hear today 2 different cases. The facts as related to you as the nature of the offense of Mr. George by his counsel, and the facts that I am about to relate to you are going to look to you and sound to you like entirely 2 different matters. This appeal is only from that portion of the referee's report recommending revocation of the respondent's license to practice law, and in spite of the fact that the respondent has commented upon the referee's findings of fact both here today and in his briefs, those findings and conclusions were not challenged. In this proceeding, the referee's findings of fact are not clearly erroneous. His conclusions of misconduct are not challenged, and the level of discipline he recommended is appropriate, namely revocation of the respondent's license to practice law in Wisconsin. Just exactly what are those facts that were found by the referee? They can be summarized as follows. Mr. George pleaded guilty to a violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 371, which alleged a conspiracy to commit offenses against federal program funds. When he entered his guilty plea on January 22, 2004, the United States Attorney recited into the record a summary of the facts which the government would have offered at trial, and the respondent acknowledged on the record under oath that he was pleading guilty to the crime based on those facts. The facts recited indicated that while the respondent was a licensed attorney and a state senator, he exercised influence over the state of Wisconsin's use of federal dollars. That respondent misused his position as a state senator by obtaining money from individuals and entities that were receiving those federal dollars from the state. Those monies were obtained by respondent because he conspired with attorney Mark Sosterich to enter into a bogus fee arrangement with a company administering federal funds known as Opportunities Industrialization of Greater Milwaukee. They're called OIC in the briefs and in the exhibits that you've seen. The illegal plan was for OIC to hire Sosterich, pay him monthly fees for legal work, and then have Sosterich kick back the lion's share of the fees to Mr. George. The U.S. Attorney further recited at the plea hearing.
Was the word kickback used?
The word kickback, was the word kickback used in the plea agreement? I'm not sure.
Who used the word
kickback? Those may be my words. He did. He passed the money to Mr. George.
Mr. Basting, we were told, at least what I understood, was that the arrangement was 80% to Sosterich and 20% to George. Is that not correct?
Yeah.
Is it just the opposite?
The other way around.
80% to George?
80% to George. The lion's share of the fees went to Mr. George.
All right. Thank you.
And it's important to keep in mind here, and I should mention this because it's in the findings in the Sosterich case, which were not challenged in that case either. That case came here, I believe, as a result of. And at finding 62 of the referee's report in that case, the referee indicated that Sosterich was unaware of a contractual provision between OIC and the state of Wisconsin, which barred OIC from employing or remunerating persons who were employees or officials of the state of Wisconsin. That's why OIC couldn't pay Senator George at that time directly, and the arrangement between Sosterich to get this money to George in a different fashion took place. That illegal plan, the U.S. Attorney further recited that at the plea hearing that Sosterich, in accord with a cooperation agreement with the government, would have testified to this illegal arrangement. The U.S. Attorney also recited into the record that while the respondent was a state senator, he helped to secure contracts for a businessman by the name of John Bowles. Bowles, under a grant of immunity, would have testified at trial that he gave Mr. George cash, which we later learned in another reported case was $200,000, which included payments to the Atlantic Broadcasting Corporation, a TV station in the Virgin Islands associated with the respondent's family. Excuse me. Bowles would have further testified that those payments were, in essence, a reward to Mr. George for obtaining the contracts. Finally, the U.S. Attorney indicated at the plea hearing
that he would have proven that respondent used his aides when he was a state senator to conduct his personal business at the taxpayer's expense. And that allegation later became part of the restitution order that Judge Randa made in this case after the restitution issue was remanded to him by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. After those facts that I just told you were recited into the record at the plea hearing, the respondent was asked this, quote, "Are those the facts to which you are pleading guilty here today, as those facts relate to you?" Unquote. And the respondent answered, "Yes, Your Honor." By pleading guilty, Mr. George basically acknowledged that he not only violated his sworn duties as a public official, but that he also used his law license to commit the crime. He now comes to this court, and he argues that his conviction is not serious enough to warrant the revocation of his law license. OLR disagrees and urges this court to revoke his license. He asks this court to look at a whole series of cases which he claims, and which were recited here today, justifies his request for a suspension. Although OLR does not believe that such an analysis is necessary, we've cited in our brief a number of cases where similar or even less serious conduct resulted in revocation. And I'm not going to go into those in this argument, obviously. However, this court has clearly stated in the Houseman case, which is cited in the briefs, that in cases based on an attorney's criminal conviction, each case must be assessed on the basis of its own facts. And there is no standard 2-year suspension of an attorney's license to practice law following the attorney's criminal conviction. Rather, this court has said it imposes the sanction it deems appropriate under the circumstances of each case, regardless of the referee's recommendation.
Counsel, on the basis of that, you're requesting affirmance of Radcliffe, which is 5 years.
I'm sorry?
Which is revocation.
Yes.
Which is 5 years at a minimum.
A revocation does not allow the respondent to apply for reinstatement until 5 years from the date. So if the court imposed revocation and made it retroactive to the date of his suspension, which was April 1st, 04, he would not be eligible to apply for reinstatement until any time after April 1st of 09, which is, give or take a few days, 15 months or so from today's date.
Well, that's, my question was really going to be, what's your position on retroactivity of the revocation?
OLR in the past has taken the position, and the court, I believe, in many of these cases where there's been a summary suspension and either a resulting revocation or a resulting suspension, that it be made retroactive to the date of the summary suspension, and we are not arguing otherwise in this case.
Okay.
Counsel, we have heard argument regarding the many years of dedicated public service. What weight, if any, in the analysis should that play?
My reaction to that has been and is today that when a public official or when anyone falls from the top, the consequences of the injury to that person are almost always much more severe than when someone slips from a lower level. So I think the fact that Mr. George has a history of exemplary service makes it even more egregious that he would have participated in this scheme that I'm describing to you today that resulted in his conviction. Mr. George has not acknowledged his guilt in spite of his argument here today. He continues to take the position that this was basically a simple inadvertent mistake on his filings with the state of Wisconsin. One only needs to look at his brief where he repeats the referee's question that was asked of him during the hearing. What did you do wrong then? Asked the referee. And Mr. George answered, well, I think that if by not disclosing my law clients on my ethics statement, I violated the law, then I'm guilty of that. He continues to describe what have been called these paybacks or kickbacks he received from Sosterich as a fee-sharing arrangement. One only needs to read Judge Easterbrook's opinion in the U.S. versus Carl G. case. Carl G. was the principal of OIC, who was also charged and convicted of a crime. His case was appealed to the Seventh Circuit, and Judge Easterbrook wrote the opinion in that case. Judge Easterbrook succinctly described the conduct of Mr. George in that case when he wrote that the jury found that money had passed from OIC, Carl G.'s company, to Mr. George in two ways. First, OIC gave Sosterich a monthly retainer fee, 80% of which Sosterich kicked over to George, although George never performed any legal work in exchange for the money. Secondly, OIC invested $200,000 of an affiliate's money in a corporation controlled by George's family, whose sole asset was a television station in the Virgin Islands. Judge Easterbrook writes further that although G represented to his affiliate that it would receive 20% of the corporate stock, no certificates were ever issued, and the investment never appeared on the corporation's books. The money, Judge Easterbrook writes, seems to have gone straight to George's pocket in exchange for his political patronage. The ABA standards, which were referred to for imposing lawyer sanctions, at Section 5.21 state that revocation is generally appropriate when a lawyer in an official or governmental position knowingly misuses that position with the intent to obtain a significant benefit for himself. In other words, violation of the public trust. That's what we're talking about here today. Violation of the public trust by a lawyer public official is an extremely serious matter, which reflects badly on the entire legal profession in the public's eye. This court, in the Hunsick case, pointed out that Hunsick's position as a public official constituted a violation of the public trust and was an aggravating factor which this court considered in the Hunsick case. Respondent was a public official and a lawyer when he engaged in this serious criminal conduct. He used his law license to support his criminal activity. He violated the public trust. His license to practice law should be revoked. The court should require him to pay the costs of this proceeding, and the court should further require that as a condition of reinstatement, he be required to comply with the federal court orders in the criminal case, which include restitution. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Basting. Mr. Cahill.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Well, this is indeed two cases, two separate cases, two different cases, much as Mr. Basting said. First of all, Mr. George has acknowledged, he has never claimed, that his failure to list law clients from whom he received more than $1,000 on his financial disclosure statements was inadvertent. Mr. Basting said so in his brief, and he just said so to you now, and there's nowhere in this record that he has said anything of the kind. He pled guilty to a federal felony
Counselor, what about the $200 paid by Mr. Bowles?
The $200,000 paid to Mr.
$200,000. Right. How should we look at that?
There's a clever way that that has been phrased in the material that just was recited to you by Mr. Basting. He owed a fiduciary duty to the state of Wisconsin. He exercised substantial influence. He received $200,000 as an investment in the broadcasting company from Mr. Bowles. And there's no evidence, no allegation in this record that Senator George procured or that Mr. Bowles obtained any benefit through Senator George.
Was
whatever Mr. Bowles
given,
may have thought he was paying that money for.
Excuse me, Counselor. Was stock given in the broadcasting company to Mr. Bowles in exchange for the $200,000?
I believe that there was a recitation in the federal proceedings that a stock certificates were not issued. And whether that's part of this record or not, I don't know.
When I heard the recitation of these facts that came from Mr. George's plea hearing, it sounded to me like he admitted that those $200,000 payments that he received through the broadcasting or that were made to the broadcasting company were a violation of the law to have received them. Do you disagree with that characterization? That is what he said at the plea hearing?
He acknowledged that he received the money.
Okay.
He contended consistently in the disciplinary case and otherwise that he did render legal services both to OIC and to Mr. Bowles, and that the investment in the broadcasting company was legitimate. He did acknowledge that, as the government's offer of proof suggested, Mr. Bowles was going to say, well, I was just paying that because I thought it would get me influence. The contracts that Mr. Bowles enjoyed with the state of Wisconsin were competitively bid in a process that Mr. George had nothing whatsoever to do with. So whether he thought he was befriending someone who was a position to use influence for his benefit or not, I don't know what Mr. Bowles thought.
Well,
it seems as though he was to testify about that, but that doesn't mean that there was corruption.
Either I misunderstood what was read, and I can get the record out and look at it, what was read at his plea hearing, or you are changing what was said at his plea hearing. And that's the thing I need you to straighten me out on. Because when I heard Mr. Bastings, it sounded like Mr. George admitted that the $200,000 payment were rewards, I think was the term that was used, for Mr. George getting state contracts for Mr. Bowles. Now, if he didn't admit to that in the plea hearing, you need to point that out to me. If he did, then you need to acknowledge it and explain to me what effect that should have on the discipline that will come down today.
I think that Mr. Basting did accurately read what the U.S. attorney recited at the sentencing hearing about what Mr. Bowles would contend, and then having recited that and a host of other allegations, Mr. George did say, yes, that's what I'm acknowledging. I don't know if that is tantamount to saying, it certainly is not tantamount to saying, I did wield influence for the benefit of Mr. George in violation of my fiduciary duty to the state of Wisconsin. But I think he was acknowledging that Mr. Bowles may have conceived of that arrangement as one that was going to benefit him in some fashion like that, because Mr. Bowles evidently was prepared to testify that I paid Mr. George this money for this work that he did and as an investment in anticipation that that's what I was going to get.
Thank you.
The $200,000, I thought, was not for work that was done,
right,
but rather to be part of this enterprise in the Virgin Islands.
Yes. There was $200,000 payment that was an investment, but there was also legal work performed by Senator George, Attorney George, on behalf of Mr. Bowles, and he testified that he worked and did legal work both for OIC and for Mr. Bowles. And just saying that it's a kickback doesn't make it so. OIC knew that Mr. George was receiving money, and the fact that Attorney Sostrich, and I believe Attorney Sostrich was in fact ignorant of a prohibition in the contract between OIC and the state on the using a vendor who was an employee or an officer of the state of Wisconsin, and there's nothing in this record to suggest that Mr. George wasn't equally ignorant of that provision in that contract between OIC and the state. I'd submit to you that he was. There's the other thing that I think bears mentioning is that a lot of factors, much as my co-counsel has alluded, there's a lot of factors that go into the acceptance of a plea agreement in the federal system, other than culpability of every allegation that is made by the federal government. There's no evidence in this record that suggests that Mr. George should be revoked. The ABA guidelines that were read to you and the ones that are cited, the six cases, by the way, that are cited in the referee's report and in the OLR's brief, if you contrast those cases and look at the ABA section that is alluded to in collectively describing them, we're talking about serious misconduct, theft, murder, conspiracy to commit murder, none of which is applicable to this case. And half those cases involve petitions for revocation by consent accepted by this court. We ask that you suspend.
Thank you, counsel. As you note, there are two seats empty here, and Justices Prosser and Butler will not be participating.
Have recused themselves?
Having said they're not participating.
Thank you.
That concludes our hearing in 05AP1978-D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Gary R. George. The court has now concluded its December oral arguments, and we are adjourned until the January docket. The court will meet in conference room at 2:40.